multiplication, and then finally the addition of the round key, which is simply an XOR, right? So we look at through this each one by one. The byte substitution is once again just a simple lookup table. So we have a lookup table for encryption, and then, well, in this case, an S box is a substitution box, but it's a lookup table for encryption, and we have another inverse S box for the decryption, right? So, for example, we can see that if we have 0 and 0, the mapping is 63. If we would go to the 6 and to the 3, we will see that it maps down back to a 0 again, right? So, quite simple to implement. One thing to keep in mind, though, is that in the standard, the S box and inverse S box is given, right? And they are chosen to be of a certain format, contain certain numbers by the designers. And if you decide to make your own S box with your own random numbers in it, the cipher will not be secure, right? So use the S box and inverse S box as given in the standard. It's not just some random numbers that have been filled into the box. They have somehow been very carefully chosen to have some important quality, right? So for this example, I'm not going to do it in class, but if somebody is really interested in how the cipher works and you want to work out one single round yourself, I have given an example. So at the beginning of the round, the state is this one on the right, and after the substitution box, the state should be the one on the left. So if you want to go through and see that everything works, so for example, this thing, the first one is EA back to 87, these back to 87 over there. If you want to check it out for yourself, you can just follow this example and check out your answer. Okay. The second transformation that happens is the shift row. So once again, just like the substitution, the shift row is very easy. The first row of the matrix is not going to shift at all. So the first row of the matrix stays the same. The second row of the matrix is going to move 1 to the left. So the 3 is going to move here, the 2 is going to move here, the 1 is going to move here, and the 0 is going to move around. Right? And then in the third row, everything is going to move left by 2. So 3 is going to move here, the 2 is going to move here, the 1 is going to move here, and the 0 is going to move here. And then the last one, everything is going to move around by 3. So this one is going to move here, this one is basically going to move here, this one is going to move here, and this 0 is going to move here. Right? A very simple rotation of the matrix, right? And once again, there's a work example if you want to check it with the numbers. So far, so good. So we can't expect everything to be so easy. So now we get to the one transform that is a little bit more tricky. And that is the mixed column. So the mixed column is basically a matrix multiplication over a finite field of order 8. And there's an irreducible polynomial that makes sure that if we multiply, the answer is not larger than any of the values in the finite field, right? And once again, this irreducible polynomial is given, so you can't just make it whatever you want. Okay, so in terms of matrix multiplication, if you remember sort of high school or undergraduate mathematics, if you're looking for this one here, it's basically this row multiplied by this column. So 2 times this value, plus 3 times this value, plus 1 times this value, plus 1 times this value, gives you the first value here. Okay, so that's the matrix multiplication. So what do we mean by finite field? Okay, so as I said, this is not really a crypto course, but we still try and explain a little bit towards you. So the basic idea of a finite field is that we have a finite field of a given order. Okay? So usually if we have a finite field of 2 to the n, it has an order of n. Okay? So in AES the order is 8, but to then we're going to go a little bit smaller, so we can work with a finite field or order 3 down here. The basic idea of a finite field is that I have a number of values that I can work with, and they're all within a set. And if I add, subtract, multiply, or divide in a certain way, the answer will also be within the set. Right? So if we have a finite field of order 3, basically we have 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Those are our 8 values. Right? And whether we add, subtract, multiply, or divide, our answer should also always be within that range. Okay. So one of the first things that we can do when we think about finite fields is that we can basically, each finite field has basically just 2 to the n elements, 2 to the n numbers. And we can define them as polynomials, where all the polynomials have that format of a to the n minus 1 times x to the n minus 1 times a to the n minus 2 times x to the n minus 2, all the way down to a1x plus a0. Whether a is always a value of 0 or 1, depending on whether the corresponding bit of the value that we're trying to represent with the polynomial is a 0 or a 1. So if we look at our very simple example, if we have a finite field with 2 to the 8, we should have 2 to the 3, sorry, we have 8 polynomials. 2 to the 3 polynomial, and the polynomial is going to be a2x squared plus a1x plus a0. And the idea is that this polynomial basically represents a binary value, right? So the total number of values you can have is 8, and it goes from 0, 0, 0 to 1, 1, 1. So if we want to represent 0, 0, 0 as a polynomial, it means a2 is 0, a1 is 0, and a0 is 0. So the polynomial is just a 0, right? If I want to represent 1, 1, 1 as a polynomial, that means 1 times x squared plus 1 times x plus 1, which is then x squared plus x plus 1. Right. If I wanted to do 1, 0, 0, it would be x squared plus 0, x plus 0. So it would just be x squared. Right? So these polynomials are just sort of a way to represent binary value or binary representation data as an algebraic expression. So it's not all that tricky how we get to the polynomial. Addition is also quite easy. So if we add two polynomials together, we treat it almost like a simple XOR. So if we have two of the same polynomials added to each other, they will just cancel out. So if we have x squared plus 1 plus x squared plus x plus 1, x squared plus x squared just cancels out, 1 plus 1 just cancels out, and we are left with an x. If we have x squared plus x squared plus x squared, two of them will cancel out, but we still have an x squared there. So addition of these polynomials is quite easy. Where things become slightly different and difficult is with the multiplication. Right? The moment we're going to multiply polynomials together, it's very easy that we're going to get something that is outside our field. Right? We're going to get a larger number than we should. Hence, we do the modulo with the irreducible polynomial to always limit the size of the answer that we're going to get to stay within the finite field. So we have exactly the same polynomials as before, right? If we have fx times g of x squared plus 1 times x squared plus x plus 1, so this is the same as binary value 1, 0, 1 times binary value 1, 1, 1, right? But this is polynomial 4. If we multiply everything up, and it's just simple, good old algebraic multiplication. X squared times x squared is x to the 4, right? X squared times x is x to the 3. X squared times 1 is x squared. 1 times x squared is x squared. 1 times x is x. 1 times 1 is 1. And we then add them together, we get x to the 4, x to the 3 plus x plus 2. But we're not supposed to have any value that's larger than x to the 2, because that would be outside our finite field x squared plus x. And if we do the modulo reduction, so whenever we have anything multiplied by the modulo, it has no remainder, and it basically reduces to zero, and we are left with x squared plus x. Okay? So essentially what it now tells us is that function f times function g, which is 1, 0, 1 times 1, 1, 1, is equal to 1, 1, 0. Because x squared is a 1, x is a 1, there is no final 0. Right? So it just represents 1, 1, 0. Right? And this is just an example of order 2, 3. Right? So in terms of AES, we do exactly the same thing, but the irreducible polynomial is in, sorry, the value here. So if you wanted to do an example of how it works, I have done one for you that is worked out. I'm not going to work it out in class or read it out in class for you, but if you are interested in knowing how this works, and it's not compulsory that you are interested to know how it works, right, you can follow my example. The one thing I'll note at the beginning is just the mapping, right? So over here, we're doing matrix multiplication, right? So we have 87, 60, 46, and 83, 86, and we are multiplying it by 2, 3, 1, 1. So we basically have 2 times 87, 3 times 60, plus 46, plus 86, right? Which is what is written at the top here. And that is the hexadecimal value, and there's the corresponding binary value. So if you want to represent 87x as a polynomial, we first make it into binary, which is 1000011. And if we write the corresponding polynomial down, this would be an x7, no x6, no x5, no x4, no x3, x2, x, and a 0, which is this one. Right? So that's the mapping. And after that, you just multiply out, you cancel all the double terms out, and then you do factorization and you do reduction. If you're interested in it, you can take a look. If you don't see how it works, then I'll have to explain it to you later. Right. Then the last round function is the addition, right? So we simply take our round key, which is also 128 bits, and we XOR it to our state matrix. Right, so this is also once again very easy. So the add round key, the shifting and substitution are all easy, the mixing here's a little bit more complicated. So in short, if we look at our total round function, we have our state, we substitute each of the independent bytes, we then shift all the rows, we multiply it by our mixed column matrix, do the irreducible polynomial reduction, and finally we do an XOR, right? So in terms of looking at how these things work, so the finite field mathematics is maybe a little bit new, seems a little bit complex, but a lot of these things are quite simple. We are just substituting the byte value. We are just rotating the matrix row by one. We are just doing an XOR, right? So if you had to go away and code this, it would probably be reasonably easy. Okay? That said, if you were to go and design this, it would be extremely hard. Right. So I can show you this slide, and I can explain to you how AES works. And everybody knows what substitution is, everybody knows what rotation is, everybody can multiply by a matrix, everybody can do an XOR. Those are basic mathematical binary operations. Right? However, if you want to know why all of these things work, why the values were chosen in a certain way, then you can go buy the book written by the designers of AES, right? And I believe that book is about 350 pages, right? And it will explain to you all the mathematics behind why these specific functions are very good for creating that diffusion, confusion, and completion we talked about before. Right. Which brings me to the final point. If you have good crypto, because AES is considered extremely good, if we had to quickly study it in 20 minutes, it is easy for us to try and understand. Right? It is therefore easy for us to implement. is don't design your own crypto. Right? I'm going to study specific mathematics and cryptography for years and years and years and years, and then you get to a stage where you are a massive expert, right? Of which, honestly, there's maybe only a few people in the world. We'll see later when we talk about hash functions. The same guy that designed AES also was on the team that designed the new secure hash algorithm, right? So clearly, there's a couple of... If you think about that competition that this runs, from the, I don't know, the 100 proposals they got from people who were really, really smart, only 4 turned out to be good, right? And this was proposed by people who were experts in this area, right? And only 4 of their proposals worked in there. So it is very, very, very difficult to design crypto for anyone, even somebody that's experienced it, right? Which is why we come back, why we never really design new crypto algorithms regularly, but always like try to implement the ones in standard that is already there. Okay. So one more thing to discuss is the round function. So in DES, we also have round functions. We start off with a scheduling algorithm that's going to expand our keys for us. Basically, we end up with a key state that's 8x8 bytes, right? And we split it up into words, right? Word 1, word 2, word 2, and word 3. Words are 32 bits in length. And every single time we want to go to the next round function, we take the word 3, we do a net rotate of 1, we do a byte substitution, and then we do an XOR with a constant. And the constant is given in the standard, and that gives us a permutation that we XOR to W0 to give it W4. W4 is an XOR to W1 to give it W5. W5 is an XOR to W3 to give it W6. And W6 is an XOR to W3 to give it W7. And every single time we do the round, we do this round again to try and update it. Okay. Right, so that's the end of AES. Right. So just to come back to key space. Key space we use to estimate the total amount of brute force effort we need to break a symmetric cipher. Key space is all the possible keys that you can have for any specific design. So for DES, we had a 56-bit key, so our key space is 256. When we had substitution cipher, the key space was all possible alphabets that we could have, so we could see it was 26 factorial. For AES, it could be 2 to the 128. 192 or 2 to the 256. For one time pad, the size of the cipher depended on the size of the message. So if the message was 1,000 bits long, our key space would be 2 to 1,000. Right? And then what is the key space for RC4? So RC4 has a variable key size between, let's say, 40 and 2048. So the key space would be anything from 2 to the 40 to 2048. Right. Okay. Which brings us to the next problem. So up to now we've talked about the block cipher, and the block cipher has a fixed block size. So for AES, it's 128 bits. But none of the data that we want to send is only 128 bits. It's obviously going to be longer. So how do we actually use block ciphers to encrypt things in practice? Right? Should we have basically a new key for each block? Now that would be incredibly difficult to implement. It would be worse than a one-time pad, essentially. Should we try and encrypt each block independently? This seems like a very obvious option. We could just take our message, split it into our 128-bit blocks, encrypt block 1, encrypt block 2, encrypt block 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, etc. Right? Or should we do something smarter where we basically make the ciphertext dependent not only on the current plain text, but also on other plain text blocks? In other words, should we chain something together? If we are going to do multiple blocks, we also need to think about how to handle partial blocks, because my message might not be entirely an exact multiple of the block size. Right? At least the last one is quite easy to think of, so we should just basically do padding. Right? We should basically pad everything to be a multiple of 128 bits if we're using AES, or at least a multiple of whatever block size So the ways that we implement block ciphers to encrypt long message are called modes of operation. So there are lots of modes of operation, and we will discuss about three, and then we briefly discuss a fourth. The first one is the electronic code mode. So that would basically be encrypting each one independently. We'll show that this one is very seriously broken. Then we can try cipher block chaining, where we chain certain blocks together, right? And we will also look at counter mode. So counter mode is a slight interesting one, because counter mode is built using a block cipher, but it looks a lot like a scheme cipher, right? And we'll look at the benefits of that when we get to it. Right. So the first method that we could look at is ECD mode. So our notation is our ciphertext is equal to the encryption of key K of ciphertext block P and the plaintext block P. Plaintext block P is the encryption using key K of the cipher block C. Okay. So there's various notations that we can use. This is one notation. Everything before the comma is the key value. Alternatively, we can also have E underscore K bracket P. That's another way people write the word. It's the same thing. So for ECD mode, ciphertext block 1 is the encryption of plaintext block 0. Ciphertext block 1 is the encryption of plaintext block 1. And ciphertext block 2 is the encryption of plaintext block 2. And to decrypt, P0 is equal to the decryption of C0, P1 is the decryption of C1, and P2 is the decryption of C2. So we see each one of the blocks are encrypted completely independently. Right. So one of the ways that this goes wrong is that an attacker can reorder the blocks. So we have a message that basically says Alice likes Bob. This is like the old word for like. Alice likes Bob and Judy likes Tom. And then we assume that it divides into P0, P1, P2, and P3 as follows. And we encrypt everything and we have C0, C1, C2, and C3. The only problem is Judy doesn't necessarily like this. And she goes and modifies the ciphertext blocks to be C0, C3, C2, and C1. And now Alice likes Tom and Judy likes Paul. Right? And this was very easy for her to do, just by basically shuffling the ciphertext blocks around. Right? So very easy. Right? Because there's every single plaintext block just maps to one corresponding ciphertext block. The second thing that happens with ECD is that if we encrypt the same plaintext twice, we're going to end up with the same ciphertext. So if Trudy is sitting there and she sees that CI is equal to CJ, she knows that the two plaintext blocks for these ciphertexts were the same. Right? And this gives her some information. She doesn't know what the plaintext is, but it does give her some information. So is this a serious issue? It depends on what we're using it for. In some cases, it does not matter. In some cases where Trudy can then observe a specific action being taken, it might be more serious. This is referred to as traffic analysis. Sometimes people look merely at traffic pattern, not necessarily looking at the ciphertext or plaintext itself. Right? So Trudy might be watching a specific bank. She might see a transaction coming from a customer because she sees the source IP. And then later in the day, she sees that the bank buys that person a certain amount of stock. Right? So all that Trudy does is she keeps watching, and next week she sees a similar transaction. Right? So she sees that some of the ciphertext values are exactly the same, coming from the same customer. So she's going to guess that most likely later today there's going to be another stock order for that company buying the same company. Right? So then she can predict. If you have a situation like this, this could be a problem. Right. So if we want to illustrate it in another way, right, we can encrypt Alice. So here we have a just a black and white image of Alice, and we're going to encrypt this image using ECD mode. Right? And when we encrypt it with ECD mode, and then we try and map the ciphertext values back to certain grayscale, we basically still end up with Alice. Right? We don't have Alice exactly, but we still have the pattern. Right? And why does this happen? Because the same plain text we've now basically built a substitution site for a head. Our alphabet is much bigger because our alphabet is 2 to the n, where n is the number of bits of the block size. But we still have the same issue we had with substitution cipher, right? The ciphertext is going to have the same patterns and same statistical properties as our plain text, right? And obviously this is not good. And we've talked at length when we discussed substitution ciphers why this is not good. So what is a better way of doing this? So a better way of doing this is CBC mode, where we try and make the current ciphertext block depend not only on the current plaintext mode, but also all other plaintext blocks that have gone before. Right, so we can do some chaining. So in CBC mode, we have an initialization vector, which is random, but does not have to be secret. And then we'll have C0 is the encryption of ID XOR to P0. C1 is the encryption of C0 XOR to P1. And C2 is the encryption of C1 XOR to P2. P0 is then the decryption of C0 XOR to ID. P1 is the decryption of C1 XOR to C0. And P2 is equal to the decryption of C2 XOR to C1. So we can see what we've done now. If we do C1, it depends on T1, but it also depends on the previous ciphertext. So, if we do the same thing with others, as we did with ECP mode, and we see what the effect is, others have not completely disappeared. Right? Because if we now encrypt the same underlying binary value for in CBC mode, it's not going to map to exactly the same ciphertext value. Because that ciphertext value now not only depends on the current plaintext block that we're encrypting, but also all the previous plaintext blocks that were encrypted, right? So it is much better at having stronger dependence of all the underlying plaintext if we calculate in ciphertext, right? So apart from being secure, what makes a good mode, right? So we already said message dependence of the ciphertext. The ciphertext depends on more than the current plaintext. We want limited error propagation. We'll talk about error propagation shortly. If something goes wrong, how quickly does it recover, right? We ideally want some kind of block synchronization if we want to recover from error propagation. And we want to maybe optimize some other things. So maybe we want to reduce encryption, encryption. Maybe we want to encrypt on byte size only, not encrypt and decrypt. Maybe there are some other things that we need to consider in terms of the wider impact of our system of what we are trying to do. And all of this would feed into what we decide is the best block cipher for us. Right. So in terms of transmission errors, we can have two kinds of errors. We can either have transmission error or we can have transmission loss. For transmission error, if I send Bob my message and I send him C0, and one of the bits of C0, let's say, goes wrong, and Bob gets a different version of C0, then it's a transmission error. If I send Bob C0, C1, and C2, and C1 goes missing completely, and Bob only gets C0 and C2, that's a transmission loss. There's basically an entire block has gone missing. Error propagation is, once we have an error, how long will this error affect Bob for? Is the current block going to be incorrect, but then Bob will start getting the correct plaintext up? Will the next couple of blocks will be incorrect, and then Bob gets the correct plaintext up? Or will basically be the rest of the message for Bob is destroyed? Right? So how long after we've made an error does the Azure error actually continue or propagate on? Okay. Right. So we'll look at that a little bit more in detail shortly. The next mode of operation we can look at is counter mode. And counter mode works as follows. We will not encrypt the P0 actually. We will choose a counter value, the initialization vector or the initial value. We can choose it as 0, we can choose it as 1, whatever we want. Let's say we choose it as 0. So we encrypt 0 and we XOR the result of P0 to give us C1. And then we encrypt 1 and we XOR the result of P1 to give us C2, and we encrypt 2, and we encrypt that with P2 to give us C2. And to decrypt, the receiver has started So you see, the interesting thing with counter mode now is we use a block cipher to encrypt this value, but it actually acts like a stream cipher, right? Because if we look back at the stream cipher model, we had a key, we had a pseudo random function or a key stream generator. We would XOR that key stream to the plain text. The recipient would make the same key stream XOR to the ciphertext and get the plain text back. So in this case, rather than have a special key stream generator, we basically made a key stream generator with the block cipher. Right. So it's actually a block cipher, it's a block cipher mode of operation, but we can argue that it approximates basically a stream cipher. Right. So people like this mode, for example, because this mode is very strong for if we store in files and we want to read and write very quickly. So remember, when quickly consider this, let's say we have a database of customer, right? And every customer is encrypted as one block. So customer 1 is C0, customer 2 is C1, and customer 3 is C2. Okay? And now customer wants us to update their details. So let's say customer 2 wants to update their details. Now we have to decrypt C1. So we just take the corresponding offset of the initialization vector. We encrypt it, right? We XOR it with the C1 value to get the plain text. We then read the plain text. We update the plain text, right? And then we write it back in, and we XOR it to this value again to encrypt, right? We don't need to update anything to C0, we don't need to up-to-date anything to C2, right? Let's say we try to do the same thing with CVC mode, right? Let's say customer two comes along and says, you need to update my record, okay? To decrypt is quite easy, because I just take the previous value, the previous record stored on this, which is C0, and I XOR it to the description of C1. I have the customer's record now. Okay? Now I update the customer's record, I write it back to the file, and I encrypt it again as C1 is equal to the encryption of C0 and the new Q1. But now what else do I need to do? Now that I've updated C1, what else do I need to do to the rest of the file if I use DBC mode? I have to then decrypt and update the entire rest of the file, right? Because originally C2 depended on C1. But now I've modified C1. So now I have to go make a new C2 with the new C1. And that means I have to decrypt P2, re-encrypt P2 to a new C1 with a new C2, sorry, with a new C1. And if my file was very long, I would now be stuck basically re-updating the entire rest of the file from the point where I modified. Right? So in that case, if we are just doing random write read, counter mode has an advantage. Because if I update P1, I don't have to update C2 or C0. I only update C1. That's just one example. The next one I'll just show for interest is CFD mode. So CFD is almost a combination of counter mode and CDC mode. Because we basically still doing chaining, but we're also essentially building a stream cipher. Right? So in this case, C0 is P0 XOR to the initialization vector, C1 is P1 XOR to the encryption of C0, and C2 is P2 XOR to the encryption of C1. So you see, we still have the stream cipher like XOR to encrypt and decrypt, but the way we calculate our key stream in this case is slightly different. Because every time the key stream for the current block depends on the ciphertext for the previous block. Okay. So that brings us to the question of error propagation. Right? So if we went to counter mode, for example, let's say we calculated C0, C1, and C2, and we send it to Bob. So Alice makes C0, C1, and C2. She sends it to Bob. But on the way to Bob, part of C0 is corrupted. So there's some mistake in C0. What effect does that have on Bob okay because C1 was okay, right? When P2 is going to be okay because C2 is okay, right? What about you look at CPC mode? Same exercise. We take C0, C1, and C2. On the way to Bob, C0 has errors. Okay. What is Bob's P0 going to look like? Is P0 going to be okay or not okay? Not okay, right? Because it depends on C0. And C0 it was wrong. So now we use wrong thing to calculate P0. So P0 is incorrect. What about P1? Okay or not okay? Not okay, right? Because P1 still depends on C0. What about P2? Okay or not okay? P2 is okay, right? Because P2 does not actually depend on C0. By now, the Bob is only using C1 and C2 to calculate P2, right? And both of those are correct, right? So in this case, when we talk about error propagation, we say the error propagation is two blocks. Because one error at C0 makes P0 incorrect, it makes P1 incorrect, but P2 is wrong. We can look at this in slightly different form. So if we look at CPC mode, the basic idea of CPC mode is we have an initialization vector. We XOR that to P, it gives us a value, and we encrypt it with PK. That gives us our ciphertext. Right? And Alice will cache the ciphertext, and she sends it to Bob. Bob currently has the correct ID cache. And along this way, C goes wrong. Right? So she takes the correct ID, she decrypts the wrong thing. She XORs it to the correct ID, which she gets it to the correct key, right? And then it caches this C for her. So if we look at it like this, it works as follows. CI is incorrect. We decrypt it, which means this value is incorrect. But the cache value, the previous ciphertext block, is correct. But that doesn't really matter if the XOR incorrect thing to correct thing to make incorrect thing. Then the recipient caches this block. Decrypt the next ciphertext block. The next ciphertext block comes in, it's correct, decrypts it, right? Correct, XORs it to the wrong thing, incorrect, but caches the CI plus 1 at the top. So CI plus 2 comes in, we decrypt it, it's correct, XOR it to the correct thing, and that gives us the correct thing, right? So it works itself out in two iterations and two blocks. So usually, for an example, I think the CBC or CFP, so I have pictures of that. So then, whichever one I don't talk, you can look at in notes. If I push the note pages, I have a full written explanation of how a similar thing happens in CFP. Without doing the picture in CFP, just quickly talk to what happened. It's, in CFP, if C0 is incorrect, which of P0, P1, and P2 will be incorrect? If I send C0, C1, and C2, and there's an error in C0, what happens to P0, P1, P2? P0 is okay, not okay. Not okay. P1 is okay, not okay. Not okay. P2 is? Okay. Good. Yeah. So CFP has a similar property as CFP. Right? If you want to get really, really complicated, there's a slight difference in the way it works. Because I think in CFP there's a one bit error and then a many bit error, where in CPC it's a many bit error and then a one bit error. But we don't worry about that. In terms of propagation, it's two blocks. Okay, so just to end with a general discussion. So we've looked at all of this, we spent 2 weeks looking at symmetric key encryption. We looked at our kind of underlying construction of AES and AES. If you are not a big cryptographer and you're not big in finite fields and things, but you are interested in building secure systems, what is the practical knowledge you can take away here? Right? How do I know if I design a system or I want to buy a system that I'm using? using a good symmetric cipher. Right? So the basic cipher analysis you can do in under a minute is the first thing you look at is the key size. If the key size is too short, it's bad. Right as we stand here today, anything shorter with a key size of 128 is not okay. Right? Pretty soon when we get to 2030, some people already say we have to go larger. Right? Second thing is, the cipher has to be public. Remember when we talked about Kirchhoff's principle? The cipher is only considered secure if you can make it public. The only thing people do not know is the key, and it still performs well. Right? Public ciphers have been through public scrutiny, and they have some additional quality that comes from them. Right? This leads on to the third point. Right? You have to consider if the cipher comes from an open competition, or whether it's some proprietary thing made by a company and is hidden from you. Right? If it's in a standard, and the standard is recommended for use, it's most likely okay. If you have older ciphers that are not standardized, but they are public, and despite being public, no one has managed to break them for a very long time, they might also be okay. But the preference is to have something in the standard. And the next thing that's important to ask is mode of operation. Right. It's very common if you read pamphlet for security product, for them not to mention anything about mode of operation. Pamphlets like to say stuff like, our product has military-grade encryption. Usually it means AES. Okay? But if they are using it in ECB mode, that obviously is not very good, and basically then the weakness is not with the AES, but the way they use it. Right? So the follow-up question should always be, okay, I really like the fact that you're using AES, but how are you actually using it to encrypt the data? And if they cannot answer that satisfactorily, you should probably find another product where they can explain what they are doing. Something with CPC mode or another more with block cipher. These days, most people use authenticated block ciphers, mode of operations, which we'll look at a little bit when we look at the integrity picture. Right. This is a short case study for you to practice. A long time ago, 1995, Philips, or NXP Semiconductor, brought out a smart card product called the MiFi Classic. And the MiFi Classic was secured using a Steam cipher called Crypto1. It had a 48-bit key, and it was not made public. Right? This card became very popular, and basically for the entire Europe, and I think large parts of the US, people used for access control, for traveling, and for both payment systems. Right? So the cipher was kept secret and it was secure for a very long time. Right? So the question is, if I was trying to sell you the cipher product today, if I said, you are building a new system, I have smart card to sell you, should you buy the system or not? And if not, why not? What should scare you in this description? That suggest to you that you should not buy it. Is this a public system? No, right? Because it's kept secret, right? It's a proprietary product, right? What do you think about the key size? Is the key size long enough? No, right? Shorter than this. This was a 56-bit key that already got broken in 1998. Right? Very easily. So, key size too small, cipher kept secret. Warning sign that we should not use this product. Right? What eventually happened to this product is around 2006-2007, some students, or a student project, PhD student, went and reverse engineered the cipher. And then they made it public. And then the moment cryptography people looked at the cipher, they realized that the cipher was actually incredibly bad. Right? And there were various attacks you could do on this product. I think if you recorded two transactions, you can basically guess the key of this in a second. Okay? And overnight, basically, a lot of these systems became insecure. Right? Because these cards are not secure. Right? And this reality, it wasn't mitigated because most of the systems are basically online systems, so they keep a copy of the card in the back end. So if you went and forged a card or modified the card, it would be detected. But still, people were not very happy that this happened, right? So how did they do it? Just to show you how easy it is to basically reverse engineer things, even though you think it would be quite hard, is they actually took the smart card, and inside the smart card would be the integrated circuit, the chip, right? What you do is you put some acid on the package, and the acid will dissolve the plastic, and will dissolve the protective metal layer. And then you get to the top logic layer. So the top logic layer and maybe the second layer are always interconnects. They basically connect parts of the circuitry together. You can see their lines are run across. Then they'll put the acid on again. You time it for a certain amount and then you wash it away, which means the acid eats through the top metal layer, you can see the second metal layer. And then you can put a drop of acid on again, wait for it for a specific amount of time and then wash it away. It will eat through the second layer and you get to the bottom layer. You can see the bottom layer looks different, right? And the bottom layer is actually your logic, right? So these are metal substrates that make up semiconductor, that make up the logic of the binary operation. So basically you have inputs, you have two gates, NAND gates, not AND gates, you have these are AND or inverter. And you can basically then, what they did was they wrote some computer vision program at the time to look at the photos, to match specific patterns, and then see what the logic was. And then they used the top two layers to see how these logic gates were basically connected together, and at the end they end up with the cipher diagram. Right? And this is a very standard architecture for a linear feedback shift register based stream cycle. Right? Every clock cycle you basically shift everything through once and you end up with one bit of E3. Right? And once they made a Wikipedia page with the cipher, then everybody else could look at it and decide if it was really bad. So just to sort of make it so we don't only say this one specific product was bad, and they comment about security of obscurity as a whole. Around the time they did this, when people realized that this was possible, other people started doing this with all the products of the time, right? And basically exactly the same thing happened with a number of proprietary RFID embedded systems. So you had the Micro Classic, you had the NXP HiTech, you had the Microchip P-Log, you had Texas Instruments Digital Signature Transponder. This one here was also quite interesting because at the time it was used for a lot of interesting things. So they used a different approach. Texas Instruments had filed a patent for the cipher, so it didn't say exactly how it worked, but they had the basic architecture. But they didn't know exactly what it looked like. So they sort of built their own little high computing cluster at the time with a whole bunch of FPGA boards, and they brute force searched for certain combination of feedback register values until they figured out what the cipher looked like exactly. And then once they figured out how it worked exactly, they also found out that it was quite easy to break. They could basically brute force search the keys, I think, in 40 hours or a couple of hours. And the important thing of this is that this one was at the time used for a lot of cars as the security for your immobilizer. So if the tag is there on your keychain, the car will start. But if it's not there, the car will not start. Right? And it was also used to buy fuel in the US. So they had some YouTube videos of them like speeding each other's car, driving around, where they did this for the fuel. Right? In this case, for the TI, you have similar issues, right? You have 40-bit key, cryptoclassic, micro classic, was it 48-bit key, and it was all proprietary. Right. So all of these things broke because they were basically only secure because they were obscure, and as ciphers, they were actually quite outdated. So it's a reminder that if we want to build systems today, make sure your P-side is long enough, make sure you have a open, public, vetted cipher and product, and that should give you some assurance that your product will perform. Okay, that is it. years,